Today, we are honored to have Imam Jamar Rahman, one of the internationally known interfaith amigos, in our studio. We have him here in our studio, who has joined us to share his views on interfaith dialogue. Imam Jamar Rahman, along with Pastor Don McKenzie and Rabbi Ted Fercon, now known as the Interfaith Amigos, started working together after 9/11. Since then, they have brought their unique blend of spiritual wisdom and humor to audiences in the U.S., Canada, Israel, Palestine, Japan, and many other countries around the world. In this very episode, in this very conversation, today's conversation, getting to the heart of interfaith dialogue, Imam Jamar Rahman will talk about his deeply personal journey to interfaith collaboration that offers hope for an inclusive and healing way of being together in the world. Based on the transforming stories and lived experiences narrated in the book he co-authored with his interfaith amigos, the Interfaith Amigos, Getting to the Heart of Interfaith, the eye-opening, hope-filled friendship of a pastor, a rabbi, and an imam. Imam Rahman will talk about ways we can work together to transcend the differences that have divided us historically. We are excited and ignited to have Imam Jamar on the ISM radio program. Let's talk about it. Imam Jamar, thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
Brother Basil, it's joy and privilege to be on the program. Thank you.
Wonderful. We are honored. Honestly, it's a great privilege having you on our on the ISM radio program. And we know that our listeners, our community, all those who are listening to this important conversation are happy that you are here and for the wonderful conversation that we're going to be having on getting to the heart of interfaith dialogue. And to you, our listeners, and all those who have called in to ask questions or add their voice to the conversation, once again, I welcome you to this important discussion. We want you to relax and make yourself comfortable. This is going to be a public dialogue. So feel free to call into the show, add your voice to the conversation, and make your views known to the world. The number to call is 323-642-1236. Question or add your voice to the conversation, call 323-642-1236. If you are outside the United States, you must dial 1 before 323-642-1236. Imam Jamar, I just want to turn to you right now because this conversation is very timely. We are living in a world where people all over the world are watching the news. People all over the world are following what is going on around the world in their countries, in their various cities, their various communities. There is a kind of conversation going on. A lot of people are lost, and people are beginning to wonder what exactly is the motivation of the religiously motivated conflicts that we have around the world. And there are questions. How could we honestly come together as one humanity to a kind of spark up a conversation that will really solve the problems that politicians themselves are struggling with? And this is interfaith. This is the heart of interfaith dialogue. And I want to ask you, Imam Jamar, what exactly is...
Thank you for the question. For me personally, it is the willingness and the capacity to enter into relationships and activities between people of different religions or with those of no religion. And it's very critical to emphasize, like you have just said, that this is essential. It is not just about hospitality. It really is a matter of our survival. That wonderful theologian, Hans Küng, he said, you know, there can be no peace among nations without peace among religions. And there can be no peace among the religions without dialogue among the religions. Now, as a Muslim, if I look at the universal verses in the Quran, there's several verses that say that if Allah wanted, if God wanted, God could have made one single community. But out of a divine design, God chose to create diversity so we might come to know the other on a human level. And that is probably the core, the essence of interfaith. And by the way, I'm not saying that Muslims are following these universal injunctions and principles of the Quran, nor are non-Muslims following that, because it is very inconvenient. We are attached to our, shall I say, narrow parochial self-interest. But we have to realize that we simply have to reach across, embrace diversity, and connect to the other on a human level. That is interfaith.
Wonderful. A very inspiring definition of interfaith. And I'm sure that a lot of people who are listening are wondering, how could we actually get to adhere steps to get to this very interfaith dialogue? Could you, Imam Jamar, could you please describe the different stages on the interfaith journey?
Oh, absolutely, and thank you so much for that question, because it's so critical. The first stage, we have realized, I and my interfaith amigos, my rabbi and pastor, that it is critical, as we've been emphasizing, not to get over invested in theology or politics or religion. The first step is just to come to know the other heart to heart on a human level. Can we share stories, human stories? You know, a wonderful writer once said, this universe is made not from atoms, but out of stories. Can we, as they say in Central Asia, can we share 3 cups of tea? Listen, respect, and connect. So, as a Muslim, I'm very conscious of this. You know, in New York, you might remember this controversy not too long ago about the decision to build an interfaith center on Ground Zero, and there was such a hue and cry about the fact that they'd build a mosque also in that interfaith center. And sure enough, all the national polling showed that 60% of people said, I don't want a mosque to be built in my state or even in Ground Zero. Only 37% said they were in favor of a mosque to be built. So where is the good news here? The good news is that each of the 60% who said no mosque, each one said, I don't know personally even one Muslim. And each of the 37% who said yes, they said, I know at least one Muslim personally. So that's number one, to connect on a human level. Stage number two is, let's then have an appreciative understanding of other traditions. It was Gandhi who said, if you really want peace in a multi-religious society, it is your sacred duty to have an appreciative understanding of other traditions, of at least the core teachings. The third stage is, once you've done that and you've established a relationship, there is some trust, then we can begin to talk about the truths and untruths, not in your religion, in my own religion. You know, Gandhi was fond of talking about this. And if some people got upset, he would say, I'm not saying that your revelations are not divine, but please remember that human consciousness is less than divine. And when human consciousness touches a divine verse, the understanding can be less than divine. So interpretations really, they vary. The fourth step, which is only possible when there is a relationship, there is trust, but most important of all, there's a willingness to be vulnerable, then we can enter into more difficult conversations. For example, you know, I and my interfaith amigos have gone to many states in the U.S. And we found many Abrahamic organizations, they do well until the conflict of Israel-Palestine comes up. And because they have not developed a human personal relationship, it goes only that far, it breaks apart. So the willingness to have difficult conversations. The fifth step is to realize that all the different religions are really, as our Interfaith amigos say, that they're paths to a shared universal. And to have the personal experience to, you know, to study the beauty and wisdom of other traditions. So, for example, I, as a Muslim, when I am open to the insights and practices of other traditions, this, I find, waters my own Islamic roots. That is why we say interfaith is not about conversion. It is about completion, becoming a more complete, developed human being. And the sixth stage, the last one for us right now, is to realize that there is a critical need for spiritual practices. Every tradition has the most beautiful, timeless, placeless, universal verses. Like, for example, love your enemy. In Islam, there's a verse that says, repel evil with something which is better, so that your enemy becomes your intimate, bosom friend. Another one says, in the Quran, it says, be witnesses to truth, even if it means you're testifying against yourself, your relatives, your parents, rich or poor. So you see, beautiful practices, but how do we live them unless we do spiritual practices to become a more developed, a more evolved human being? So those are some of the six stages that we outline in our most recent book coming out end of this month.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Imam Jamar. These are different stages, the six different stages that you have highlighted are very important, I'm sure our listeners now and all those who will be listening to this podcast from on our website will be completely happy to explore practical steps to actually achieving them. And I want to ask you from a practical perspective, why did you decide to devote your life and ministry to interfaith?
Thank you. Well, first of all, in my education, in my training, I've always been very fascinated by the universal verses in the Quran. The one I just mentioned, that God has deliberately, out of a divine design, created diversity. So you might, it says for two reasons, you might compete with one another in doing righteous deeds. But the one most emphasized and the one I've been repeating again and again is so that you might come to know the other. So for me, from a young age, studying those verses, I realized this is very critical. It's a matter of our survival to come to know the other. Secondly, on a personal level, my parents were diplomats. And so we've traveled in different parts of the world. And traveling does something, really. It opens your mind and heart to diversity. And my loving parents, they encourage their children to visit different houses of worship. So at an early age, I became aware of the beauty and wisdom of all other religions. And then as an adult, it has become clear to me that really our problems in the world, doesn't matter what it is, social justice, environment, religion, politics, culture, race, they are so huge, so momentous, that we have no choice, because there is no one religion, one culture, one nation come these gigantic problems. We have, as I say, no choice but to cooperate and collaborate. And maybe one more point I'll mention, very critical, that after 9/11, when we got together with my I as an imam, with my rabbi and my pastor friend, we realized how, when these circumstances brought us together, how critical this work is of cooperation and collaboration among ourselves. So sometimes, for example, when we go across the country and we three of us stand together in front of audiences, sometimes very large audiences, we can see that just by us standing together and when we do our conversation, people realize that we are friends. We have a personal relationship. And we begin to see tears. Sometimes we see the tears glistening in people's eyes. And we realize that it's not because they are so captivated by Jamal or Ted or Don. It's because when we stand together and they realize we are friends, it gives hope and vision. So for us, that has become a lifelong ministry to be the Interfaith Amigos and share a message of inclusivity.
A message of inclusivity. For those who are joining us, we are talking with Imam Jamal Rahman, one of the internationally known Interfaith Amigos, who is here in our studio, to share his views on how to get to the heart of interfaith. We're going to be taking a short break right now. When we come back, we will look at how these very Interfaith Amigos, how they started, especially those who are listening, those who want to get inspiration from this important group, a group that started after 9/11, promoting interfaith dialogue and collaboration. How did they start? What can we learn from this group, the foundation of an important group that has inspired people in many countries around the world? We're going to be talking with Imam Jamal after a short break.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners. Those who have joined us, those who are listening on our website, are from many countries around the world. We are talking with Imam Jamal. Imam Jamal, there is an important audio clip where you and your interfaith amigos, your colleagues, were describing the beginning and the purpose of Interfaith Amigos. That audio clip is just very important, very, very inspiring. And I just want our listeners to listen to this very audio clip for a minute.
We've been working together over the past 10 years because the events that followed the horror of 9/11 let us know how far we are from peaceful solutions to the world's problems. And it also let us know that religion itself is often part of the problem.
We wanted to find out why interfaith dialogue had not been able to help us get to a place of deeper understanding and even reconciliation.
It's really amazing that each of our traditions contains words of beauty and substance, and yet our world is filled with anger, pain, polarization.
And we've learned when speaking about spirituality that it's often important to begin with a moment of silence. We share many words, but the silence we share is one. The ancient psalmist said, "Be still, be quiet, and remember the deeper wisdom that arises from within you."
In the wilderness, Jesus experienced the same silence we meet now, as he prepared himself for his ministry of teaching and healing.
The Quran invites us into the sacred womb of silence, where it is said, angels and the spirit descend. So when we slow
when
down
we
a
slow
little,
down a
it
little.
Becomes possible.
When we
slow down
a little,
it is clear
It is also possible to remember
the deep spiritual teachings
of our traditions.
Amen.
Imam Jamal, this is a very powerful message that you and your colleague are bringing to the world. I want to ask you, you raised so many important themes in this audio clip. Silence, the core teachings in our traditions. I want to ask you, how did the Interfaith Amigos start?
You know, the catalyst was 9/11, as you had mentioned. And Brother Ted, my rabbi, he invited me as a Muslim in that very tense period to speak at his Friday Shabbat. And then we realized that we have what is called a kinship of spirit. We became friends. And then over time, our families became friends. Our congregations became friends. And, you know, a point we have been stressing again and again, the core essential need to connect on a human level. And we realized that we're cousins of the same Abrahamic family, but a very, very, very dysfunctional Abrahamic family. But we did realize that it is so wonderful that once you become friends and you dialogue, this is the best way to heal and overcome our dysfunction. But then we realized that our third cousin is missing. And that's where Brother Don comes in. Don was initially a friend of Rabbi Ted. And then the three of us became friends, deepened our friendship. We began to do spiritual direction among ourselves, to one another, to become better human beings. We discussed about our religions. We learned about and had an appreciative understanding of one another's traditions. And, you know, we began to realize that, again, if there's a human connection, no matter what the differences are, whether religion or politics, now, because we have the human connection, this no longer looms as a threat. And we can focus on larger issues. And by the way, as we three became friends, we started doing interfaith programs, first in our own state and other states. People started calling us the three amigos. And then we realized we have to be culturally sensitive, because we began to find some Hispanic groups that were unhappy, that were they experienced pain in us being called three amigos, because this brought up the issue, I guess, of a movie that was named Three Amigos, and they felt that this disparaged the Hispanics as a group. So because of that, now we are called the Three Interfaith Amigos, and not just Three Amigos.
Mm. Very important, the Three Interfaith Amigos. And each of you is bringing something very important from your different traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And there are major aspects of those religions, each of those religions. And some of those aspects are where you are the Three Amigos. I talked about them in 2010, talked about the teachings in those three faiths, in Christianity, in Islam, and in Judaism, the three core, the fundamental teachings, and also the ontologies in those religions. I just want to play a very short clip where three of you were talking about this, and I'm going to ask you a very important question based on this very clip. Let's listen.
So what we've done is identified three major aspects of every tradition. The first is appreciating that each tradition has a core teaching. Not that there aren't many teachings in every tradition, and not that we don't share, but every tradition seems to have a central focus. And then every tradition has particular aspects within that faith, within those texts, within the rituals, within the practices that support and enhance that core teaching. And then there are aspects within each tradition which are less comfortable. If truth be told, there are aspects in all traditions that are awkward, and when measured against the core teaching, often need special interpretation or special commentary. And we strive to look at the core teachings, the particular blessings of each of our traditions, and the awkwardness.
Wonderful. Very important aspects, the three aspects of every religion. In this audio clip, Rabbi Ted Falcon talks about the three major aspects of every religion, the core teachings of each religious tradition, the particular rituals and practices that support and enhance the core teachings, and the aspects that are less comfortable. And in Rabbi Ted's own words, those aspects that are uncomfortable could be a little bit awkward. I want to ask you, Ibam Jamar, what are the fundamental beliefs in each of the three Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam?
You know, on the level of essence, it is the same, really, essence-wise, meaning each of those traditions and all other religions, they talk about how can we become a better human being? How can we transform our ego, open our heart, and then be of service to God's creation? But it is at the level of theology and beliefs, shall we say, in the level of form, that we get stuck, really. You had mentioned core teachings. So, for example, my rabbi friend says the core teaching is in Judaism is oneness. Of course, there's oneness in Islam and Christianity also, but it's emphasized in Judaism, says my rabbi Ted Falcon. My Christian brother, Pastor Don McKenzie, says for him the core teaching is love, unconditional love. That's the primary teaching of Christianity. For me as a Muslim, if I study the Quran, for me, the core teaching is compassion. Compassion for self and compassion for others. But the question is, are we living them? And how can we find common ground among those? It is by realizing that we have to live and practice these core teachings. And that is, of course, humanly quite difficult.
Very important. And you touched upon the very question I was going to ask you. How could we find a common ground, given the fact that the Jews claim they are the chosen people of God? Christians believe they have the truth to eternal life. As Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And Muslims believe Islam is the final true religion as it was revealed by the last prophet Muhammad, peace be unto him. Now, I want to ask you, given these discrepancies, kind of beliefs that are a little bit different from one another, each religion believes it has the ultimate truth. How could we find a common ground given all these belief systems?
Yes. You know, first of all, again, to come back to that major point, if we find people who sincerely and truly believe that theirs is the only path, the key point is not to debate or argue that, but really to connect with that person on a human level. And this is not, you know, I keep saying it again and again, but the fact is it's simple but very difficult. It's not easy, because we always have an agenda, and it cannot be scripted. It has to, it has to be natural. It has to flow from our humility, our lack of agenda, from our sincerity. It requires persistence to connect on that level. Then what happens is, if we connect by really listening, sharing stories, then even if that person believes it's the only way, because now we have a human relationship, it is no longer possible to demonize or dehumanize the other. Now, from my perspective, for me, Jamal, and I believe for my interfaith amigos, when I say, this is the only way, or I'm the chosen people, or my holy book is superior to yours, for me, it is not religion speaking, it is my ego speaking. So for me, it is very important that I do what every religion tells me to do to transform my ego, to open up my heart, to become more inclusive. But again, the key becomes, even if the other has that view, I must realize that I must go beyond form, enter into essence, and develop a human relationship. For me, and just for me, and I believe for my interfaith amigos, I love to listen what sages say, that if my relationship with my religion comes in the way of my relationship with you, then for sure it will come in the way of my relationship with God. So let us be all inclusive and have an open heart.
And have an open heart. And unfortunately, many people around the world do not subscribe or even believe in inclusivity. Many feel excluded. And because of one thing or the other, people are not even open to accept those who do not belong to their very group. And I want to ask you, Imam, it is believed by many people that religion is both the cause and solution of most of the conflicts we have in our world. Now, in your opinion, what do you think are the promises and problems of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam? How can we overcome violent extremism and terrorism?
That's a very deep question. Well, first of all, the promise of every tradition is that if you follow that particular path, you will become a more complete, more developed human being, and you'll become more fulfilled. But then again, the key is that it asks us to practice those insights, those exercises, what we call spiritual practices. And that's very inconvenient. So I'd rather teach you how to do that than rather practice it myself. The problem becomes that we become too invested in the religious institutions. You know, there's a familiar story in the monotheistic traditions that God comes down and reveals certain basic truths to some people. But then the devil comes along and says, let me organize that for you. And that becomes religion. So we have to realize that over time, our religious institutions become overly focused on fundraising and recruitment, and we lose sight of doing the work which is contained in every tradition about really living the spiritual message of that particular tradition. So we find that if we honor the form and not the essence and don't do the spiritual practices, there are four areas where we go astray. In most religions, where the first one you mentioned is exclusivity. My religion is superior to yours. Another area is violence. A third area is unequal status of women. And the fourth area is homophobia. How do we overcome these? And again, this is a question of practicing what is at the essence of each of our traditions, which includes spiritual practices, so we become a more developed human being. We transform our ego. We open our heart. And maybe in our enlightened mind, realize that every holy book has two kinds of verses, particular and universal. Particular verses are in desperate need of historical and textual context. Universal verses are timeless, placeless, wise. The problem becomes, and this is what extremists do, religious extremists, the problem becomes when we take a particular verse and advocate that as a universal verse. That is something we have to be very, very careful about. There's one more important point. Yes, there is religious extremism. But human beings are not genetically predisposed to hate. The brain is not wired to kill. This verse in the Quran I study from time to time and reflect on. The verse in the Quran says, when there is chronic fear, anger, hate, hopelessness, and helplessness, it's not that the eyes become blind, the hearts become blind. And this is not really always rooted in religion. Very often religion is used as a cover to disguise what at the root is a conflict, a terrible conflict over economics and politics. So in a sense, you might say, as spiritual teachers say, we're looking among the branches and leaves for what appears in the roots. Yes, of course, there is religious extremism. As they focus on particular verses, not on universal verses. Yes, there is religious extremism, but the root of it, the bulk of it really, has roots in a terrible conflict over economics and politics. I love that wonderful saying by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who said, if only it was so simple that there are some evil people out there, and all we have to do is to separate them, isolate them, and destroy them. He says, alas, the line dividing good and evil runs through every single human heart. And who is willing to tear a piece of his or her own heart? So this fight against extremism has many roots.
Wonderful. And a lot of politicians, a lot of policymakers, many people around the world are struggling on how to counter violent extremism. And I believe especially those who are in the conflict resolution field, many people are talking about transforming intractable conflicts, or especially violent extremism. We're going to be asking Imam Jamar questions on how to transform hostile relationships through interfaith dialogue. We're going to be asking this question after a short break.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners, all those who are here with us in our studio, those who are listening on our website and through other channels where we are broadcasting this important conversation live with Imam Jamar. Imam Jamar is one of the Interfaith Amigos. He's here with us and he's been inspiring us through his wealth of knowledge and experience in interfaith dialogue. Imam Jamar, let's look at the transformation of hostile relationship through interfaith. What roles has interfaith played or could play in transforming the hostile relationship between the Israelis and the Palestinians?
Very difficult question, because my goodness, so much of research goes into this and so little results, really. For me, it's a very deep tragedy, because it almost seems like history, destiny, and mystery has conspired to place two noble groups of people against each other, the Israelis and the Palestinians, who have both suffered so much. and have been so heroic, and yet they have, you know, sunk to the lowest of the lowest, and at times gone to the highest of the highest. So how can we, you know, bring peace here? I go back to the basics. It has to begin at the grassroots level to know the other. I love those programs, both in Israel and Palestine. For example, the one where bereaved Israeli parents whose children have died in suicide bombings, who get together and connect with and dialogue with Palestinian parents whose children have been killed by the Israeli Defense Forces. When they get together and when they converse at the heart level, at the senselessness of this violence, of this killing, and they get in touch with their feelings and their pain, this is what makes all of us realize that how futile violence is. And the best way is to simply, on a human level, connect. But of course, it is the hardest way to do that. And you know, these people, when they get together, they've come up with a very important point, that in dealing with the adversary, it is very important to make a distinction between behavior and being. A person's behavior might be absolutely unacceptable, evil, violent, but a person's being is sacred. It's Christ nature, Elohim nature, Allah nature, Buddha nature, Krishna nature. And as I take the right action, if I keep this discernment, this distinction in mind between behavior and being, the sages say this has the power to shift heaven and earth. I am fighting the antagonism, not the antagonist. There's a wonderful 17th century spiritual Islamic teacher who says, please, do what is right. But I beg you, as you take the right action, please, do not keep person's being, essence, out of your heart. And just this discernment has the power to shift heaven and earth. Now, you know, after 9/11, a good number of Jews and Muslims, they continued to dialogue, to talk about the elephant in the room, Israel-Palestine. They became friends. And my Jewish friends tell me it is these abiding human connections between the Jews and the Muslims who became friends and began to really go deep into this Israeli-Palestinian conflict, cover all aspects of it, without denying, without avoiding. This is what has given impetus to this group, which is growing larger and larger, Jewish Voices for Peace, J Street Lobby. So this persistent work of sharing three cups of tea, of connecting at a grassroots level, can have deep and lasting effects.
I mean, these are wonderful, inspiring words. And I hope our listeners and all of us, will be going to ponder, contemplate on these important, inspiring words that you are feeding us with today. We think that it's just very important, and again, sad for the victims of the Palestinians, those who have suffered in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and as well as the Israelis, the other people at the other side of the aisle, who have fallen victim, the human nature, the human aspect of this very conflict, and not only between the Israelis and the Palestinians as well, also those conflicts are intractable, violent conflicts going on within countries, inside countries, in Nigeria, in Syria, in Iraq, in many other countries, Central African Republic, where we have these religiously motivated conflicts. And this brings me to this very important question, again, some of which I got from your book. And I want to commend you, Imam Jamar, and your colleagues for the great research. You have scholarly research. You have been involved in this field of interfaith dialogue. Most of us have benefited from your work. We are living in a century when many people tend to believe only in science, a century when many people say they are spiritual and not religious. Now, the reason for not believing in religion may be, as a result of a lot of things that are happening. It could also be ascribed to the numerous religiously motivated violence that we experience in many countries around the world. And this very phenomenon, you and your colleagues explained it so much in your book, Religion Gone Astray, What We Found at the Heart of Interfaith, a book you co-authored with Pastor Don McKenzie and Rabbi Ted Fekun. And a book which was published in 2011 by Skylight Publishing. And in this important book, I just want our listeners to know what you said, or what the book actually, the essence of the book. It is said, many of us acknowledge difficulty with some aspects of our own religious tradition, even if we are wholly devoted to our faith identity. Now, these vulnerabilities can inhibit meaningful personal engagement in faith tradition, but they can also feed misunderstanding between religious institutions and undermine any hope of authentic interfaith dialogue. Now, most importantly, you probe more deeply into the problematic aspects of our religious institutions to provide a profound understanding of the nature of what divides us. Now, you identify four common problem areas in the Abrahamic faiths. You mentioned these areas, these core problems earlier on in this show: exclusivity, violence, inequality of men and women, and homophobia, as well as their origins. Now, for those who are listening to this important conversation, you can get a copy of this book, Religion Gone Astray, What We Found at the Heart of Interfaith Dialogue, a book published by our distinguished guest. Get this book from Amazon, or you go to their website, the website of the Interfaith Amigos, to be able to find a link through which you can procure a copy of this important book. Now, I want to ask you, Imam, in what ways do you think critics or even politicians, ordinary citizens in a position of power, people in a position of power, now, in what ways do you think they use the dark side or the awkwardness of our religions as divisive weapons and a means to achieve their personal selfish goals?
Yes, it is. Those four areas you mentioned where religion goes astray, these require really spiritual practices for us to be able to overcome them. And if we don't, then yes, we use and we manipulate that. So, for example, whether you're a religious person or if you're a politician using these biases, to realize that when there is exclusivity, when we preach or believe in exclusivity, this is, as I said, not religion speaking. This is our untamed ego speaking. So for me to realize that unless I, as Muslim spiritual teachers say, make my ego not a commanding master, but my personal assistant, I'll be lost in this area of exclusivity. I will really preach that my religion is superior to all other religions. This is my pride speaking. I've got to use spiritual practices to become more humble. Then the second area, violence. You know, if there are no seeds of violence within me, no conflict inside me, then really there are no seeds to create violence outside of me. So it is very important that I, as a human being, I work on healing the conflict inside of myself. Patriarchy, unequal status of women. You know, women tell us that, for example, Muslim women tell us, there's no such thing as the Quran says this. Who says the Quran says this? It's always 100% men. So can we as human beings, if we really want to overcome conditioned, socially conditioned patriarchy, can I listen to the voices of women? And they, for example, tell us, please give us the space to express our pain. And we want to listen to your pain also. Do you realize that in your tradition, in our religion, we always say that God is beyond gender, and yet we always call God in the masculine pronoun. So can we listen to women? And so, for example, in some communities, people are beginning to exercise the speech of calling God in the feminine pronoun, at least as often as in the male pronoun. So here the task is, can we truly listen to women rather than telling them our interpretation? Then question of homophobia. You know, the best way to overcome homophobia is to get to know individuals from the LGBT community. For Muslims, this is a very difficult subject. But even Christians and Jews, the conservative ones, will cite verses in their holy book to express their total opposition to accepting gays and lesbians, same-sex marriage. But a good question is, how is it that Christian conservatives in this country today, compared to 20 years ago, are much more relaxed, are much more open to accepting gays and lesbians, including same-sex marriage? What brought about the change? And so there's some books written on this. They say that the same conservative people, they knew others in their neighborhood and in their offices, and they liked them. They just didn't know they were gay people until the conditions in the country made it safe for these people to disclose that they were gay. So this is called the bridge model. So they could not hate those people who were gay because the bridge had already been built. You know, commenting on this, another writer says, the meaning of scripture is shaped by social relations. So unless we do our spiritual work in transforming our ego, it'll be difficult for us to overcome those four areas where we go astray in our religion.
Thank you so much, Imam Jamar. We have many questions here. A lot of folks have been sending questions to our chat box, and we're going to be taking a few of those questions. But before we do that, I just want to ask you this very important question, because there are many people who do not actually believe in interfaith dialogue. Many people see little or no need to using interfaith dialogue. They just want to stick to their own religion. And we know the effects of such behaviors. These are very important signs that could lead to extremism if people are not open to accepting others, open for conversations with the other people at the other side of the aisle. I want to ask you, Imam, what message do you have for those who see little or no need for interfaith?
You know, it is a given fact that in this world we have diversity, whether it be religion, whether it be cultural, whether it be race. And so this interconnection with the other, it has to happen because we are living, we are existing together. So we have no choice. But when we deal with the other, who could be, it doesn't have to be religion, it's a person of a different race, of a different culture, I have to come face to face with my biases, my prejudices, and overcome them so I can live peacefully. In other words, I have to honor diversity. And interfaith is just about those two things, about honoring diversity by coming to know the other. I might not call it religion, but I end up really doing interfaith work without calling it that.
Very important. We're going to be taking a short break. When we come back, we're going to be asking Imam Jamal a few of the questions that we have in our chat box.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners, or those who have joined us from many countries around the world who are listening to this important conversation through various channels where we're broadcasting this show live. I want to thank you for your patience and for your passion for peace and security. We have in our studio Imam Jamal, one of the Interfaith Amigos, who is here with us, inspiring us on getting to the heart of interfaith. We have very important questions, Imam Jamal. I'm going to be asking you this. The question from Mike. Mike is in Italy listening to this important conversation right now. And Mike is asking you, in many countries, there is a problem with respect to how teachers teach interfaith courses. And Mike is asking you, are there curriculum, are there ways to which our teachers could really help young people as early as possible to begin to cultivate a culture of interfaith?
You know, the best way is at an early age to visit different houses of worship, to become friends with people who are different. And that really creates the foundation for really having an interfaith overview. As far as a curriculum is concerned, I think there is now a much deeper consciousness that we simply have to have an appreciative understanding of other religions. And it's happening more and more in Muslim countries, in third world countries. It's happening in Europe. The basic knowledge, understanding that we have no choice but to really have an appreciative understanding of the other.
Thank you so much, Imam. And Mike, I hope you can get a very important, inspiring response from Imam Jamal. And you can also consult with local communities. I'm sure there are interfaith people, ministers within where you are in Rome. And you can also reach out to Imam Jamal, go to their website, or you can reach out to the Interfaith Amigos on their website to get more information about their work. Imam, I have another important question here, and this question has to do with listening. This person is asking you that the problem we have in the world today, especially within the circle of policymakers, is that policymakers sometimes do not listen and sometimes do not recognize the minorities in their countries. What advice would you have? Do you have for policymakers?
Well, you know, it all starts at the individual level. Absolutely. People are not listening both at the individual level and at the collective level because, you know, we are conditioned to really suit and to fulfill our own personal interests. So we are basically responding or reacting to whatever really is not in the common good, but for our own particular tribal good. So I would say, let's start with myself. Can I and am I really listening to the other? And what does that really mean? You know, in mystical terms, it means that, if I quote a wonderful sage from the Islamic tradition, put your head on the other person's chest and sink into the answer. So when someone is talking, don't start thinking about what your reply will be, but put your head on the person's chest metaphorically and sink into the answer. That is real listening. So if we do that at an individual level, then hopefully our politicians will also start doing that. And this is really also a moral question, that truly we have sacrificed our moral principles on the altar of what suits our individual and our collective tribal interests. And this requires spiritual practices to go beyond that.
Very important question and very important response by Imam Jamar. Imam, I was going through what you have been doing since after the 9/11, when the Interfaith Amigos started your work. And one of the important things I've learned in my research about your work has to do with this aspect of listening from the religious perspective. What each of these traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, hold with respect to listening to the other side, listening to the other. And this is very important. I found a very important audio clip, which is reflections on how the memory of 9/11 reminds us of the importance of striving to understand the experiences of those who are different from us. And this was recorded on I think, September 11, 2009, at Barnes & Noble, where you went for a presentation, University Village in Seattle. I'm going to be playing this a little bit, and I'm going to ask you a very important question based on this clip.
How is it that each of our traditions has such words of compassion and such principles of love, and we have created the kind of world we have created?
You know, just before coming here, I was reading an article where there were some clergy who were going to help, or trying to help, some street gangs. And the street gang leader said, "You can't help us." And the clergy said, "Why?" And they said, "Because you are just like us." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Like us, you mark off your territory and you defend to the death your right to hold it. You're just like us." So I'm not talking about the institution of religion. We are not. We're talking about the spirituality within the religion.
And the other thing that is important for those of us who are Christians to understand and name is the reality that the demonization, let's say, of the Arabs and Muslims goes back a long way. Demonization by Europeans and Americans, at least to the middle of the 19th century. And we have to realize that that ability to put down the people of the Middle East has been supported by actions of the Christian church. And so we need to reverse that. We need to recover that sense of love.
Prophet Muhammad said, "Seek knowledge from the cradle to the grave." In this case, knowledge about the other, the other's religion, other's culture, other's grievances, pains, anguish, suffering. How do you do that? All the traditions have answers, similar answers. The Quran says, "Will you not listen? Will you not listen?" The truth is, Muslim or non-Muslim, we are not listening.
Very important remark by you, Imam Ramar, that the only way is through listening. And you emphasized something very important, that we are not listening. Muslims, Christians, Jews, and many other religious adherents to many other religions, that we are not listening. And you said that before you arrived at Barnes & Noble, You were reading an article, for those who are listening, just want to narrate what you said, that you were reading an article that narrated a story about three clergy who were going to help street gangs. And the gang member said, "You can't help us." And the clergy asked why. The gang member said, "You are just like us." And the clergy said, "What do you mean?" The gang member said, "You mark your own territory and you defend unto death, your right to hold it." So you narrated this story to differentiate between the institution of religion and the spirituality of religion. Now, could you explain further the difference between the institution within a religion and the spirituality within that very religion?
Yes. You know, maybe I can relate a story. One of the greatest learnings I achieved or I gained was by listening to the story of a retired Christian missionary who was, I think, in his 80s, close to 90. He said that he spent close to 40 years in Africa. And he was sent there by his superiors because they found that the locals were converting to Islam at a very alarming rate. And so this missionary said he was there in Africa and he spent his years, you know, in a sort of a conspiratorial, to use his words, life where he really conspired, he said, to show how bad Islam was. But the point of it was, he said, you know, I spent 40 years serving the kingdom of Caesar. How I wish I had spent more time serving the kingdom of Jesus. How I wish I had been less Caesar-like and more Jesus-like. So that was such an important lesson for me as a Muslim, that if I want to be a good Muslim, does it mean that my work is just to promote how beautiful Islam is and you must come around to my religion and I, you know, broadcast the beautiful verses I have? What about living them? What about the key essential work of transforming my ego, of moving from a commanding master to a personal assistant in my ego, softening my ego? How about opening up my heart so I become more inclusive of diversity, not only to accept or to honor diversity, but to celebrate diversity? What about me being of service to all of the earth community, not just my tribe, not just my religious category people, but to all of humanity? So this means that I have to serve not the institution that focuses so much on recruitment and fundraising, and I understand that, but less on that and more on living, breathing, becoming the spiritual message, which is so beautiful, that helps us to become more Jesus-like, Buddha-like, Allah-like, Krishna-like, Elohim-like, to really live that, practice that. And that is our main journey, so we could become more developed human beings.
Very important elaboration that you've just given us, Imam Jamar. And there is a question here. We have many questions, but I'm not going to take all of them. I just want to apologize to all those who are listening now. If we don't take your question because of time, actually we've exceeded our time. Because of time, we're not going to be taking all the questions. So if we don't take your question, please do not feel offended. We can get back to you with our responses to those questions that you have sent to us, which are very important to us. But again, Imam Jamar, you said in this very audio clip that we played, that Prophet Muhammad said, and I quote, "Seek knowledge from the cradle to the grave." Now, in this case, the knowledge of others' religion and culture, that's actually what you said. Now, how could all religions, not only the Muslims, step aside from their own world and move across to the other side of the eye to discover who the other truly is and not what people say the order is. Actually, that's what is going on in today's world because of violent extremism and terrorism and all that is happening. Politicians and policymakers are capitalizing on that. And the media is painting a picture that people from the other religions are, you know, somehow at the same. So giving a picture of what people are not saying, these people categorizing everybody to be the same. Everybody, if you are a Muslim, you are this. You are a Christian, you are this. You are a Jew, you are this. So how could we actually differentiate? How could we separate, go beyond what the media is projecting? Media is very powerful. That's what happened in Rwanda. The Rwandan genocide that took about 1 million people to their graves was actually inspired through the use of the media when they were broadcasting that the Tutsis were about to kill them and saying all that from Belgium. Honestly, that inspired those who were on the ground to kill, massacre more than 1 million Tutsis. And they were killed. So the powerful messages, very construed messages, negative, stereotypical messages sent out through the popular mainstream media could really damage, cause more havoc than good. So how could we step aside on a practical level to counter those violent, inspired messages that are being portrayed by the some of the media outlets and also some politicians? And this is a very important question that we want to ask. And our listeners, many of them have sent in questions that are related to this. So just, I summarized all these questions in one.
Thank you for doing that. The main, of course, way is to really do some self-witnessing of oneself and to become aware that we are so slavishly dependent on authorities, experts, pundits, you know, the media talk show people, and we fail to listen to our own inner teacher, to what our own heart is saying. You know, the Prophet Muhammad, the peace be upon him, he would say, no matter what the religious judge advises you about earthly matters, first consult your heart. And he would repeat it, consult your heart, consult your heart, consult your heart. There's a wonderful humorous teaching story called the Mulla Nasuddin. You know, the story is that he's on his, deathbed, gravely ill. His wife is crying and crying. And now in comes the expert, the allopathic doctor, the authority. And he examines the mullah at great length and then turns to the wife, quotes the Quran and says, oh, honorable wife of the mullah, you know, only Allah is immortal. Your husband is dead. His soul has flown. He gets poetic to the bosom of God. But the mullah is not dead. He's feebly, faintly saying, I'm alive, I'm alive, I'm alive. And what does the wife say? Quiet, don't argue with the doctor. You see, that reflects the state of affairs where we are so slavishly dependent on authorities. We failed to look within ourselves. A very key insight is, in dealing with the other, is, and we have learned, of course, this from the Israeli-Palestinian issue, very simple, everybody knows this, but the key insight is, how does it feel to be the other? Can I practice that? Every single religion asks me to do that. The golden rule is an extension of that. How does it feel to be the other? It could be the person who is suffering or the person who caused the suffering. How does it feel to be other? To have a higher understanding? You know, do what is right. You know, don't allow yourself to be abused. Protect yourself. but don't leave the other person's essence, being out of your heart. And part of this means, how does it feel to be the other? This is difficult spiritual work. You know, I use the word spiritual because that's what resonates for me. Or let's just call it, you know, it's important work to be done to become a more complete human being.
Very important advice. Be ourselves. Look inwardly.
Yes.
Become more compassionate, and not to depend on what the authorities, especially those are messages are coming from authorities and the media that are not actually inclined to the goodness or to promoting the goodness of the other, but inclined to destroying the other. We should ignore such messages and just be ourselves and look inwardly. We are created good. We are good. So we got to explore that goodness from ours and also appreciate and acknowledge the goodness in the other people. These are very important, powerful messages that Imam Jamar has left us with. But Imam, we got to be looking at the future of interfaith dialogue. And it's one question that many people want to hear you talk about, especially those who have sent in those questions here. And again, I'll just summarize those questions in one. It's just going to be the last question. And I know we have really taken so much of your time, but we're going to do this after this short break.
Thank you.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back, our listeners, or those who are listening, who are with us in our studio, those who have joined us from many countries to listen to Imam Jamar, one of the interfaith amigos who's been doing an incredibly great work promoting interfaith dialogue, interreligious collaboration, exploring the goodness in the other people, and going beyond the prescriptions of religions as they're prescribed by looking inwardly into what is good. And this is very important when it comes to how politicians and policymakers are, and ordinary people as teachers, how they teach, and ordinary people in many organizations or workplaces. This is very important, very timely. And so we want to know the future of interfaith dialogue. How could policymakers leverage on lessons learned and best practices of interfaith to prevent, resolve, and transform religiously motivated and faith-based conflicts that they are experiencing in their various countries?
In my opinion, and I come back to that one basic Quranic verse, which has become like a mantra for interfaith. And this is reflected in all the different traditions where the verse says, God has created diversity out of a divine design, so you might come to know the other on a human level. Now, to come to know the other on a human level, it sounds easy, but the question again arises, how can I create the environment where no matter what the difference is, people are motivated to connect on a human level? Let me give you an example. Many people criticize interfaith get-togethers because, you know, there is good food, there's beautiful music, but they're intermittent, meaning it happens infrequently. It happens just twice a year, thrice a year, maybe more, but, you know, very intermittently, infrequently. And so in those infrequent meetings, the complaint is that the talk and the behavior is absurdly nice, beautiful. But once people go home, let's say in the Abrahamic monotheistic get-togethers, once people go home, Muslims become terrorists, Christians become liars, Jews become occupiers. Unless there has been an effort in a very skillful, honest, sincere way, that the people who attended that meeting, they continue their relationship with the other in an abiding way. They truly connect with the other. And not just once or twice, but over a period of time, where they develop a relationship. And that seems to be the key. How do we create that environment, use our resources, employ our skills, where in a large gathering of diverse groups of people, whether it be religion or politics or culture or race, we are able to somehow create the environment and provide the motivation that people continue connecting with the other and go through those different stages. And because they have connected, because there's a relationship, because there is some trust, they are willing to be vulnerable and enter into more difficult conversations. That is what makes interfaith dialogue effective, productive, fruitful, when we are willing to be vulnerable, and that's only possible when you've established a personal relationship.
Wonderful. Great advice from you, Imam Jamar. And we encourage all those policymakers who are listening to this conversation. We encourage those who are at the international level, United Nations, and all the people who are listening to this conversation right now to adhere to this important. These are advice that Imam Jamar has left us with. Encourage interfaith dialogue in your communities. Encourage interfaith dialogue in your states. Encourage interfaith dialogue in your nations, in your countries. At the meetings at the United Nations, interfaith dialogue should be encouraged. In other places, we should have institutions that could really help all people at the grassroots levels promote their efforts. We have the media who are covering violent extremism and all that. And there are people at the grassroots levels doing great, great work, relationship building, interfaith dialogue, and all that. We want the media to also cover their efforts. These are ways to counter violent extremism and bring their work to the forefront. So people in many countries we know, there are great, great people doing great work in their grassroots. We have Imam Jamar Rahman and the Interfaith Amigos doing great, great work. There are many people at the grassroots level who need to be really, really promoted. We want to thank you so much, Imam Jamar Rahman, for coming on the ISOM radio program. Let's talk about it. We are completely honored. This is a blessing for us having you on the ISOM radio program.
You've been most gracious, most generous, and I've been honored, and thank you so much.
With this, I would like to end the show. I want to thank you again, our distinguished guest, Imam Jamar Rahman, a popular speaker on Islam, Sufi spirituality, and interfaith relations. He's a co-founder and Muslim Sufi minister at Seattle Interfaith Community Sanctuary. He's also an adjoint faculty at the Seattle University. And he was also an interfaith talk radio host. Next week, next Saturday, we're going to be having an important conversation on violent extremism with a great panelist from the universities and also from the Institute, U.S. Institute of Peace. We're going to be having these great people who are doing great work at the international level on the ISOM radio program. Let's talk about it to discuss violent extremism. Three great panelists from the universities and from national institutions and the U.S. Institute of Peace are coming on ISOM radio for this wonderful conversation on how to counter violent extremism. And finally, thanks to your listeners and supporters. Remember, you can always come back to listen to this important conversation. Listen to the podcast on our website, www.isomediation.org. In addition to listening to the podcast, you can also get involved There are many ways to which you can get involved in our organization. You can join the movement by signing up for our membership, by registering for our upcoming events, especially the annual International Conference on Ethnic and Religious Conflict Resolution and Peace Building, taking place in New York on November the 2nd. You can register for this on our website, www.isermediation.org. And we want to thank you again. Join us next time for another episode of the ISERM Radio program. We want to say goodbye, and may God bless you all for listening. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to ISERM Radio, a global peace network dedicated to promoting inter-ethnic and inter-religious cooperation.
For complete information about the shows, including previous podcasts, visit the ISERM Radio website, www.isermediation.org.
Stay connected. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And let your friends and colleagues know about us. Join us next time for another edition of ISERM Radio.
Peace to our world.
The AT&T plan with unlimited data for DirecTV and AT&T wireless customers gives you more of what you want. Get unlimited data when you have AT&T wireless and DirecTV. AT&T, mobilizing your world.
Must have eligible TV service. If not eligible, AT&T will move you to a new plan and overage charges may apply. After 22 gigabytes of data usage, AT&T may slow speeds. TV content varies by device, location, and package. Coverage not available everywhere. Monthly charges, usage, and other restrictions apply. See store for plan details.
Fios is not cable. We're wired differently, which means you can get the fastest internet available with equal upload and download speeds from 50 to 500 megs. So you can upload 200 photos before your favorite song is finished. Click the ad and switch to Fios today to get our best offer ever.